Welcome to the Lutheran Education Podcast, brought to you by Lutheran Special Education Ministries. In this podcast, we'll explore trends, issues, and events surrounding Lutheran education. In each episode, we'll invite educational experts to shed light on topics that support educators, administrators, and staff. Thank you for listening to LSEM's Lutheran Education Podcast.
Welcome to the Lutheran Education Podcast, brought to you by Lutheran Special Education Ministries. I'm your host, Rich Schumacher. I'm the Director of Programs and Services here at LSEM, and today we are welcoming back to the podcast Dr. Kim Markshausen. Kim, welcome back. It's good to have you again.
Well, I'm glad to be here, talking about one of my favorite subjects. You can't beat that.
Nope, that's a win-win, and it's snowing outside the window here today, and it sounds like you've got snow already down in Nebraska as well, so we can settle in by a roaring fire of our imagination and have a good conversation about parents and self-regulation.
That sounds great.
All right. So, Kim, I know what parents are, but self-regulation, that's a term that I don't hear as often. Can you just give us kind of a brief introduction, explanation of what self-regulation is?
Oh, absolutely. Self-regulation is something that's really important to learning, which is why it's becoming more of an area of interest for research and an area of interest for teachers, too.
Mm-hmm.
Self-regulation is really about taking care of your own learning and your behavior and your emotions. So those three areas, because all of the, and by learning, we primarily mean your attention, how you're focusing. So those three things, as you can see, are very important to learning. But when we talk about self-regulation, we're also looking at how you activate each one of those, how you control them, and how you evaluate them. So for instance, if we were looking at attention, we'd be talking about a child being able to draw their attention towards some learning, and to take it away from something else they're wanting to do, and to be able to stay focused on that learning, and then also to be able to do what we call metacognition, or be able to pay attention to what they are learning and to know, does this make sense? If it doesn't make sense, then I need to ask about it. So that adds on an extra level of attention. And it's the same with behavior and emotions. It's learning how to control those things and use them in good ways.
Now, is there a specific age where you start to see children being able to take this on and to grasp it more readily? Probably individualized, you know, everyone develops at a different pace, but is there a specific age range where we typically see this?
Well, I think the age range would probably be somewhere between 0 and 95, because that's just narrowing it down a little bit.
Perfect.
But self-regulation is something we are working on continually. So we typically say that infants are other-regulated. So their parents are helping them to learn how to calm down, or helping them to learn how to self-soothe, or, you know, interacting with them to teach them attention. But at every stage of life, there's learning we need to do. And so we continually grow in our ability to self-regulate.
All right. And so with self-regulation, obviously the prefix there tells me that this is something that I do and everyone does individually. It's designed for ourselves, but you're looking at how parents play a role in this. Explain a little bit about that.
Well, you know, as I mentioned a little bit ago, when you're an infant, you're other-regulated, mm-hmm. and your goal in life is to be self-regulated. That's really a good description of parenting, is that our goal is for them to be able to do these kind of things on their own. But it's something that's taught by parents, because that's a big part of the first few years of a child's life.
Okay.
And so the kind of interaction they have with their parents kind of determines how their self-regulation develops.
All right. So what are some,
to explain it, that we're basically social learners.
Okay.
So when a baby is born, what's happening in the brain is the baby is saying, who are these creatures that are taking care of me? How can I communicate with them? And how can I be like them? And so that's why it's so important for the baby. Everything the baby learns is in that interaction with parents and other people in the family.
So parents really have a great deal of control over what their kids are learning and how they're developing from a very early age. Again, very obvious statement, but in essence, it's designed to show parents just how important those interactions are and how that plays a vital role in the development of their children.
Certainly, because once you get to school, you know, teachers can reinforce self-regulation, or even in childcare, it can be reinforced. If a child is a little bit behind, you know, we have ways to help them, but primarily it's learned at home, even after a child starts school, because the brain says the most important people are the people that live with me in this house.
So as teachers, the best that we can do is be supportive, reinforcing, but really secondary. Mom and dad and the family unit itself are going to have the biggest impact then.
Yeah, so there are things that you can do in the classroom to help children with this, but this becomes an area where teachers are working with parents too. And that's kind of been my focus, is to help teachers to understand who really teaches self-regulation and then give them some tools so that they can work with parents on it.
Okay. We're talking with Kim Markshausen on parents and their role in the self-regulation as it's developed in their children here on the Lutheran Education Podcast. And Kim, I know you had a chance to present on this at LEA, the convocation in St. Louis back in October, and I'm sure you've spoken on this topic in other places as well. And so as I'm looking at the materials that you've shared with this, it seems to me like there's a number of things, a number of categories, if you will, where parents, maybe not intentionally, but parents create some roadblocks or some hurdles to this self-regulation working properly.
Yes, that's very true. I like to talk about iceberg beliefs when I talk about parents. And iceberg beliefs is really a concept from positive psychology. And it's an iceberg belief is something that would be a belief that you're not necessarily conscious of, but it's something that's pretty deep down. And it impacts the way you see the world and the way you interact with the world. So it definitely impacts how you raise your children.
Okay.
And the thing about iceberg beliefs is that in one way or another, we all have iceberg beliefs. So this isn't about bad parents have bad iceberg beliefs. This is about every parent. All of us have some kind of iceberg belief. And so if we can pay attention to these things and the fears that they cause, we can kind of counteract what we're doing at home, or a teacher can have a new perspective with the parent. It's so easy when you see a parent making a mistake parenting to think, it's just about being a bad parent. But if you can think, what is that parent afraid of? Now I can address that issue a little bit more effectively. When we look at iceberg beliefs, there's about three of them.
Okay. I was going to ask for some examples of what those might be.
So if I go through those three, then we can look at some examples too. But the three that I really center on are acceptance and control and achievement.
Okay.
So if I have, for instance, an iceberg belief of acceptance, then that means that deep down I've got this worry about whether or not other people or whether or not my children will accept me. So if that happens, I'm going to be less likely to say no to my child, because it's going to be important to me that my child likes me.
Okay. So,
and control is one where I'm going to want to control everything for the child, because I start to worry about them being able to make good decisions. And with achievement, I'm going to be the kind of parent who really wants my child to do everything the best, because that makes me look good as a parent.
So it's interesting how in all of these three things that you've got here, acceptance, control, achievement, most of this centers around the parent's own need and perception and desire to have a certain outcome. And the child is really just kind of a player in this, but it is really the mom and the dad's own perspective on how they want to see it go.
Right. And it's really just a factor of the fact that we're sinners living in a sinful world.
Sure.
So we have our own weaknesses and our own sins, and we pass them on to the next generation. So we probably have Adam and Eve to thank for these three things here.
Add it to the list. Another thing to blame Adam and Eve for.
Yeah, poor Adam and Eve.
I do suspect that that they may have set the table, but I can speak from personal experience. I've taken up the mantle myself quite well.
We all have. And, you know, that's a good perspective to have, because we don't want to, you know, I don't want teachers to think, oh, you need to be able to diagnose the psychological condition in parents. That's not going to be helpful, because, you know, we don't have the capability to do that. But instead to look at this and say, well, I, as a teacher, my iceberg beliefs impact the kids in my classroom. And here I'm seeing an example of how a parent's iceberg belief might be impacting their parenting. Let's just look at this as, here's something else where we can help each other.
Now, that's got to be a delicate balance, though, because I know from my own experiences as a teacher and as a principal, after school would be probably the classic time for this. Moms are in the building and they're having a conversation, and the kids are kind of in the area but not right standing next to them. And if they're misbehaving, as a teacher, there was always that level of hesitancy. Do I say something because the kids are still in school? But if I do, is that parent going to be upset with me because the child is technically with them and they have it under control?
Yeah, because no parent wants to be pointed out in front of others as their kids are having problems. I even remember a friend who works as a DCE, and how they were having difficulties in their contemporary service with kids running around. And so they brought in a parent meeting and talked about, you know, how children should behave in church, and they were attacked. it was not good. So the take we need to take on it, first of all, is one of reassurance, and also one of pointing to the positive consequences rather than the negative consequences. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, you might say to a parent, I know it can be a scary thing to let your child make choices, or I know it can be a scary thing to let your child survive a consequence, or I know it can be a scary thing to correct your child in front of other people. But in the long term, here's how that will help. You know, so if we take survive a consequence, you know, those parents that will leave work to bring homework papers in for a child because it's due and the child forgot to put it in the book bag, even though the mother said three times to do that.
Yep.
I'm not speaking from personal experience here, but I think I'm reliving some of my kids' childhood or something. But
I'm reliving my own childhood.
Yeah.
And my mom will vouch.
Yeah, and you turned out all right, so.
Thanks to my wife.
Yeah. Well, instead of saying to the teacher, you know, your child didn't get this homework in on time, you know, blah, 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 and focusing on the negative things, and if your child doesn't learn how to do this now, they're not going to be able to do it in middle school. All of that is true, but instead to say, you know, I see this so often, but I know that it's better for a child to suffer a small consequence now.
Yes.
And learn something now that's really going to help them later. And trust me, when your child gets to science fair time in middle school, you're going to want them to get their work done on time.
the way I've heard it explained once and I thought really made sense is we're all going to fall from time to time. You know, it's just, again, a part of life. We're going to fall. The difference is sometimes you fall off a curb and sometimes you fall off a cliff.
Yes.
As a parent, I don't want my kid to fall ever, you know, but I can't wrap them in protective bubble wrap and keep them inside and never let them, because that's not going to help them with their development. So if I had to choose between my child falling off that curb and skinning a knee or falling off that cliff and having a much more severe result, it's a no-brainer. But again, some parents seem to struggle with having that fall of any type.
Very much so. They're kind of in rescue mode, that I want to make life perfect for my child. But in reality, the more often, we don't want to make our kids fall.
No,
when they
not at all.
Fall, then there's something activated in the brain that says, hey, that was not a happy experience. We need to learn from this. And we even see this with young children making a mistake over and over again. I have a favorite clip of a toddler who's bending down to pick up a ball, and he puts it into a tennis can. And when he bends down to pick up the next tennis ball, the first one falls out. And he keeps doing that over and over again. And it's fun to watch that. But the reality is that's the way his brain says, wait a minute, we need to pay attention to two different things here. And so the same thing is true for a child making small mistakes in kindergarten or third grade or even eighth grade to prevent bigger mistakes later, like in high school or when you're paying tuition in college or when the police might be involved.
Yes. So for teachers, though, again, how they approach a parent with this reassurance, how they direct the parents toward positive consequences, and as you say here in your presentation, influencing rather than teaching. You know, I see that as a great value, especially with an adult, because I don't want to be spoken down to, but I would love that influence, that mentoring sort of thing. Any suggestions on how teachers should frame those types of conversations with parents to help get the message across, but to do so in a way that's going to be well received?
Well, a good technique is that kind of that empathy, and then you do the redirecting. And so you say, I know it can be scary, a scary thing, because if you recognize that parents often are making these mistakes because they're afraid of something, or it can be a risky thing, and then follow up with the redirection on what you want them to do. But it's also important to remember that you're not going to be teaching a parent. So that one interaction at a parent-teacher conference or after school is not likely to be what does it. It's going to be the parent hearing that message over the long haul. So not only hearing it from you, but from other teachers and the administrator and in policies that the school is doing. A good example of this is years ago, I had a home visit with parents where I was doing a home visit for their second child. And so at this home visit, they said to me, you know, we've really been reading to this child because we didn't ever read to our first child until we heard from you that reading to a child is important. Well, their first child ended up with some reading disabilities, which may have been helped some by reading with them. But I knew these parents hadn't heard that just from me. They'd heard it from me and they'd heard it from other teachers, and they knew because our school made it apparent that reading to your children was important. So we want to think about what can, you know, the little things that we can do, but also what are the big things that reinforce to parents that raising your children is your job. Because it's too easy for us as teachers and administrators to take over that.
Yeah.
You know, you've left your children at the door, now it's up to us. Now you just need to do everything we tell you to do. But instead to say, we need to be in partnership about this. And so some of the ideas that we can talk about later would likely include things that we can do as a school.
And we'll get into that conversation a lot more with Dr. Kim Markshausen in just a few moments. But first, we're going to take this break and give you a little presentation from Lutheran Special Education Ministries. You're listening to the Lutheran Education Podcast.
Lutheran Special Education Ministries is an organization committed to serving schools, churches, and families to advance the success of children who have learning needs. Our commitment to this mission began with the opening of the Lutheran School for the Deaf in Detroit. Over the years, our ministry has expanded, and today LSEM is proud to serve in Lutheran schools across the country. But as our ministry has grown, our commitment to helping students succeed academically in an environment where they can also grow spiritually is as strong as ever. So if your church or school is looking for professional development for your faculty, information to share with struggling families, or for a ministry partner to support an existing resource room or start a new one, LSEM is ready to help you meet your specialized learning goals. For more information about how LSEM can help you build brighter futures for your students, please contact us at 248-419-3390 or visit our website at www.luthsped.org. That's www.luthsped.org.
And welcome back to the Lutheran Education Podcast, brought to you by Lutheran Special Education Ministries. We're going to continue our conversation now with Dr. Kim Markshausen, talking about parents and self-regulation. We've spoken, Kim, about this whole idea of fears and these iceberg beliefs that parents have and how they impact their kids. The next section here in your presentation talks about something fairly interesting, and I don't think it's tennis related, but it's called serve and return. Tell us a little bit about what you mean by serve and return.
Well, tennis is a good analogy for it, because in tennis that ball is going back and forth, and how one person hits it determines how another person is going to return it. And that's probably why psychologists chose that term to describe this. But I'll tell you that when I first read about this, I had to just kind of stop and let it settle in, because I thought, oh, that explains so much. And so I'm kind of on a serve and return kick right now, okay, and talking about it all the time. But it really helps us to understand that impact that parents have on their children, because when children are born, as I said earlier, their brains are geared towards social learning. They want to interact with these people that they see all the time, because that's the only way they can start to build the models in their head that allow them to learn how to survive in the world. And so what's happening in serve and return is really the brain is taking statistics. Now, that was a little discouraging for me to hear when I was in graduate school, to think that an infant was better at statistics than I was in class, but I got over it. But that's basically what the brain does, because the brain is an electrical neurochemical instrument. And so it's not writing things down in cells. It's paying attention to what's happening. So the brain is saying, what kind of things happen most often? And what kind of things happen in different places? And what kind of things happen with the important people in my life, with the family members? And the answers to those questions are the things the brain says, these are the things that are important. So we are going to strengthen the neural pathways that help us to understand these things. Now, that's important because as children get older, once they start get to about 18 months, and then again at 3, and then several times in their lives, their brains do something called pruning. So they will cut out neural connections, destroy them, destroy the ones that aren't being used very well, and they'll keep and strengthen the ones that are being used. Hmm. So that's important when we think about what a child spends his time doing from infancy all the way to adolescence, where we just throw all the rules out the window.
So what you're saying is all the algebra that I don't remember from high school, just my brain just cut that loose?
That might be it. That's what I was saying when I took stats class. I didn't use those things. But it's also, you know, if a child, for instance, spends a lot of time in front of a screen, then that's going to be the parts of the brain that are strengthened. Okay. If a child spends a lot of time reading or being read to by parents, then there's going to be other things strengthened. If a child spends time doing music or learning about the faith, those are the parts of the brains that are going to get stronger. So the things that we want to see in our children when they're older are the things we need to be doing with them from day one.
So would you recommend then a balance of many of those things? You know, children who get to experience a lot of different things allows more of those pathways to be strengthened and allows them to develop more in a more well-rounded sort of way?
Yeah, that's a big part of the building those neural pathways. But if we're going to bring it back to serve and return, then we want to help parents to understand that the way they interact with their children is how their children are learning. And it's easy to dismiss it, because we're not talking so much about, you know, sitting down with a child and having that talk about sex education, the one that we all love so much, and then we write about it in their baby books. You know, it's not those big kind of lessons, but it's every little reaction or interaction, from waking a child up in the morning to the words you say to them at breakfast to, you know, how you interact when you pick them up from school. All of those little, we call them short, frequent interactions. All of those little things are where the keys to learning and the keys to self-regulation are going to happen.
So it's more important for me to sit down and read a book with my son or my daughter and have that interaction in the story than it is for me to find this really cool app on my phone that reads to my son or daughter and let them sit there by themselves while I go do something else.
Yeah, and you know, we've seen that in previous generations too. If you remember, Hooked on Phonics was supposed to teach kids phonics, but what it did is it put kids in front of a book with headphones on.
Yep.
And as a reading teacher, I knew now interacting with your child is better. But even in terms of the time your child spends in front of a screen, like if parents play a video game with the child, that's better than letting a child play on their own, because now there's also some human interaction with it.
So the technology is not bad. It's the sharing and the relationships and the interactions that help to let that piece of growing up and development flourish, as opposed to it being an isolated thing.
Right, because we don't say that screen time is in itself bad or dangerous. We don't really know. We know what kind of things aren't happening in the brain when a child is in front of a screen. But what we do know is the issue is the more time a child spends in front of a screen, if that's taking away from the time they spend interacting with their parents or their siblings or their friends, that's when things become more dangerous.
So as I'm looking here, you talk about the different learning tasks that children will have at various ages. And I'm looking specifically at the ages where the children would be students in a school from a teacher's perspective. Preschool, they're focusing on curiosity. At the elementary level, you've got peer relationships, and in adolescence, it goes into values. What lessons can teachers learn from knowing those things, and how can they help in this process if they have an awareness of that?
Well, first of all, on that chart that you're describing, we have to remember that those things are cumulative in nature. So an infant is starting with language, and then a toddler is still learning language, but adding in self-regulation.
Sure.
And then you mentioned preschool curiosity. Now it's curiosity and language and self-regulation. And then when we mentioned peer relationships too, what's important, and this is for parents and teachers as well, is that we want their school experience to involve opportunities for children to interact with their peers, to develop their sense of curiosity, and to develop their peer relationships. And so if we're looking at a preschool, I would not recommend you look for a preschool that's always talking about the academics they teach. Because as a former first grade teacher and kindergarten teacher, I had plenty of students that came to my classroom not knowing any letters or numbers. But if they had good social skills and if they had good attention, I could teach them that very quickly.
Sure.
So if you're looking for a preschool, you want a preschool that allows kids to interact with new materials and share that with each other. As well, in an elementary school or in a middle school, not just good test scores, but you want to know, are these children doing problem-solving activities and critical thinking, which means they need to be working with each other. But it's also important as you think about what your children are doing at home. So if you've got elementary age kids, if you've got a child who wants to play video games all the time, it's probably a good idea to encourage that child to play with others too, and not just playing with someone else who's in a different space, you know, doing it on the internet like that,
Sure. Mm-hmm. But
to be playing with kids face-to-face, because it's that face-to-face interaction that makes the difference.
And I think as you look at this, this is also a good message for teachers as well, because again, as a preschool teacher, you want to make sure that you're doing and providing those types of curiosity-based things to really let students have a full range of opportunity to explore and to learn, and at the elementary level to involve peers. So that's kind of a prescriptive list, I think, for our teachers as well, to make sure that we're touching on all of those things so that ultimately, as they get to adolescence and they start to establish their values, all of those things are solidly in play and are being provided by our very effective schools.
Right, because once they're adolescents, we want them to be coming to us as parents or to a teacher, to a coach, to talk about their values and not going to, heaven forbid, social media to learn about those things. And so we want to train those kids as they're growing up that God has given us other people to be in fellowship with, and seeking wisdom from other people and other adults is a good thing. The other thing, you know, that I was thinking about is how this is true for teachers, but I think it's true for parents too, is that we really want to focus on those activities that keep those nasty interactions from happening. So I always wanted a smooth recess, you know,
sure.
And I wanted, if I was going to have a work time in the classroom, you know, if everybody's doing a worksheet, I knew it was going to be quiet, and it was a little bit riskier to have the kids do a cooperative activity. And for parents driving their kids in the car, man, how easy is it to hand them each a screen? You know, then they're not going to fight. But really, if you're going on a vacation, you know, this is my generation, I had to put up with kids fighting. You did too, I'm sure.
Oh, yes.
You know? But, yeah, so it's not fair that parents now can keep their kids quiet. But the point is that even in those uncomfortable or challenging interactions, the kids are learning. So those kids at home that are sometimes fighting and sometimes getting along really well, they're going to be the ones that are going to go to school and have the better social skills because they've experienced those kind of things already.
And how interesting you mentioned that in terms of you know, the family vacation and the interactions and how nowadays screens and various technologies are used for that purpose. And, you know, just watch an hour's worth of television and the commercials are all kind of hinged around that. I mean, it's, you know, get the extra line on your phone plan, because after all, you want all your kids to be happy and immersed in their phone, and get the televisions in your car so that way they can all watch whatever they want to watch. And again, that's become this this goal that we have to keep everything happy, peaceful, and quiet, when society says that's a good thing, but the science says it's actually a pretty damaging thing.
Well, it's the emotional version of falling off a curb. You know, have 100 little spats with your brother or sister at home, and you learn how to prevent those things at school. And how many times have we as teachers had a parent just breathe a sigh of relief? I used to have that first grade all the time. Oh, my child's not a lot of trouble here, because they sure are a lot of trouble at home.
Yes.
And, you know, then I have to say, well, thank you for letting them be in trouble at home and for dealing with that, because now it's not showing up here.
Yeah, better at home than at school.
Yeah.
All right, so looking here again, regulating learning behavior, regulating emotions. Talk to us about the importance of being able to keep all of those different areas of our lives regulated, and as we develop, how that serves us in later life.
Well, one of the things that happens between a parent and a child is that, you know, the child's going to try something and they're going to wait and see what the response is.
Sure.
And the way you respond and the way you let a child know what the expectations are, and the fact that that happens again and again, that's what helps the child to realize, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do. So I like to use the example of when our son was about 18 months old. We had to put him into a toddler bed early because he just really liked to fall off the top of the crib, which, you know, helped us to understand his adolescence a little bit better. But the problem was he didn't have the self-regulation to stay in bed. So, you know, his dad and I had to park ourselves outside the door because he would say, what's going to happen if I get out of bed? And he would come out the door and we'd be right there and we'd scoop him up and put him back in bed. And so our response gave him the expectation that when we are put to bed at nighttime, you need to stay in bed. And he needed to have that happen again and again and again. And those, again, they were short, frequent interactions. Then that's how he learned that. And the same is true then for emotions too, because our children are really born with 6 basic emotions. You know, God's given us those emotions because they help us to learn. We feel joy or surprise, we're drawn towards something. If we feel fear, we pull away from it and keep ourselves safe. If we feel anger, we're more likely to do something to make a change. And even disgust is one of those emotions. If you know, disgust keeps us from eating something that's dangerous, you know, like broccoli. So, and it always seems to be broccoli, doesn't it?
It should be.
Children. But the problem is if we stay with just those 6 emotions. And so as children interact with parents and as they interact with with their peers, they learn to step those emotions down, and they learn some of the more nuanced emotions. So they learn that instead of feeling anger, you know, if a parent says, oh, you know, I can see you're really frustrated that, you know, that your socks don't match or that you couldn't find what you wanted to wear, and when the parent uses a different word for anger, then gradually the child realizes, okay, for some things in my life, I don't have to feel angry, I can feel frustrated. If I'm frustrated, then maybe I can do something about it. Or maybe I even step it down to irritation, which is, this is not something I can fix, I'm just going to have to live with it. So that's how children learn those different kinds of emotions. And then when it's their turn for learning, they come to school upset about something, they can step their emotions down and still learn, even though they're upset, and they can calm themselves down.
And I can see where this is really valuable in a school setting, because again, as a teacher, you're trying to maintain control in a room with 20, 25 children, and there's going to be irritation. You know, you expect that when you bring that many people into such a small space, and then as an adult have goals for all of them to go in the same direction at the same time. It's just irritation is just going to be kind of a natural thing. You can deal with irritation.
You're going to be irritated with the teacher too, because you're having fun building with the Legos and now she wants you to do math. Yeah. So,
and again, that can lead to frustration, and that's still easily manageable. It's a little bit more of an interaction with the teacher perhaps, but that's more manageable. But if immediately you go from the Legos to math and that creates anger, that's difficult to deal with, and it's upsetting to a classroom.
Well, and not only that, but it changes the way that child focuses. So even if you can get them calmed down, they'll be less likely to learn. If they can bring that down to frustration, then you can help them learn something else. Like, well, I understand that you want more time playing with the Legos, but you didn't get your classwork done in time. And so if you work on that better and stick with it, then you'll have more time for Legos. So now you can see how that emotion can be turned into a learning event.
Yeah. And not to mention the other impacts that has in other areas of their life, because again, if a student goes to anger quite often as kind of their initial go-to response, I mean, other kids in the room see that, and then that becomes how they relate to that student. Well, he's angry all the time, and how does that impact those relationships and friendships and what? So it can be very, very impactful if those different emotions aren't regulated like that.
Or similarly, if a child has fear and they can't step it down to being a little bit worried, then there's going to be a lot of things they're not going to want to try because they're afraid of them. But yet, if we can step it down to caution, now we're in the same area of what we call conscientiousness. And a child who has good conscientiousness, that's a strength for them in learning, because now they can think, what are the possible problems? How can I prevent that?
Yep, without ever getting anywhere near fear or even worry in that case.
Sure.
All right. Well, Kim, we're going to pause it here. So that's the bad news. But the good news is, we're going to do another podcast here, kind of talking about the second half of this presentation. So listeners, if you've enjoyed what we've been able to share here so far, this is just your teaser to come back for the next episode of the podcast, and you get to hear a little bit more from Kim. But if you can't wait, if you just cannot wait until the next time, and you need to reach out to Kim to learn more, Kim, how would they go about getting in touch with you?
I do have a website, and you can email me from that website, but my email is really just my name, kim@markshausen.net. So I'm, you know, stuck in the old days of email, but I'd be happy to answer questions or interact.
All right. Well, Kim, thank you again. Looking forward to our next conversation, which we'll have out shortly. And thank you for listening to this edition of the Lutheran Education Podcast, brought to you by Lutheran Special Education Ministries.
Thank you for listening to the Lutheran Education Podcast, brought to you by Lutheran Special Education Ministries. To hear future episodes, please subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. For more information on this episode's topic or any other questions regarding Lutheran education or Lutheran Special Education Ministries, please feel free to contact us at 248-419-3390 or visit our website at www.luthsped.org. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.